Okay, we're on the air. Okay, so I want to, so in keeping with the ambition of having Shira end at a normal late time, I'm going to try and telescope the discussion of the Tosfot really rapidly, because, and this will be reflexive, because the issues in the Tosfot will come back. What I wanted to try and show you and have you get out of the Tosfot, and I'll start by making an abstract point, that people, which relates to Midrash, which is an issue of anxiety for many of you, that there's often a confusion between the mode of presentation and the content of something. You can say the exact same thing in two entirely different modes, and people will, right, but people can mistake the mode for the mode for the substance. So, for example, in Midrash, somebody can write an academic paper exploring the motivations of a character, or they can write a narrative which concretizes the motivations of the character. They're doing the exact same thing, and it's not necessarily true that the narrative that somebody is writing may have no is not making a claim of historicity. It's a way of explaining to you one reading of the motivations of the character. So, for example, right, we have a basic problem, which is why was Abraham the only one whom God spoke to? Now, you can try and write an academic paper about the background of Abraham, or you can try and tell a story about Abraham's childhood. Both of those are addressing the same issue, and how you present it should not obscure that. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily the case. It may be that somebody's telling a story because they have a tradition that the story is real. Right? So you can't prove it. But it's often at least possible, and I think in the case of Midrash, that's one of the places where I think that the phenomenon of Midrash is often misunderstood, that the one mode of expressing interpretation is to retell the story. But it's not making a claim about the details of the retold story. Making a claim about the interpretation implied by the details of the story. Now, the relevance here is in terms of what Rashi and Tosfot are doing. Now, Rashi and Tosfot have different expressions. Rashi expresses himself as a commentary within the confines of the text. And Tosfot expresses himself, or express themselves, whatever you want to call it, as a commentary appended to the text. Okay, well, I think one issue, and we'll talk about this perhaps at greater length at some other point, right, the key to understanding Rashi as a running commentary, it doesn't just mean that Rashi's comments are appended to line by line to the Gemara, as opposed to being appended to paragraphs of the Gemara. What it means is that Rashi is supposed to be read as part of the Gemara. And therefore, argumentation... Right, much argumentation doesn't fit in Rashi because it would disrupt the flow. That doesn't tell you whether Rashi engaged in this form of argumentation, right, because you could take Tosfot and then say, okay, how do I write Tosfot up in the flow of the Gemara? And the answer would be, you write Tosfot's interpretational conclusions up. Now, we can have a separate discussion about whether, in fact, Rashi engages in the kind of balancing of sugyot that Tosfot does or not. Right? And that, I tend to take the position that yes, but you can have a reasonable conversation about whether that is true or not. But it's not, right, you can't demonstrate it from the fact that Rashi doesn't quote other sugyot, and you might be able to demonstrate the reverse from the fact that Rashi often comes to the same conclusions as Tosfot. Now, what I wanted you to get out of this exercise specifically was to see, and I hope this came clear, that all of the quite lengthy Tosfot on the sugya are responding to the exact same questions as the Rashi's I gave you. They're addressing I think of it as the seams in the text. Right? The text where you need somebody to sew pieces together. And so Rashi Rashi enables you to read those seams, and then Tosfot points out either why it is you might not have read the seam that way, you might read it differently, or the problems that occur as a result of inserting that seam. The big seams in this text are A, how you understand the machloket Rav Meir and the Rabbanan without making it a machloket in Mitzvah, and what the context of the two okimtas are. Right? Is the context Rav Meir, or is the context, right, context Rabbanan, and if it's the context, right, and if it's there, if, right, if it's in the Rabbanan, is it to be machmir or is it to be mekil? And what I want you to get is that every, right, basically every commentator on that sugya, no matter how long or what form their argumentation takes, they're all basically going to be addressing the same problem. And so one way of controlling large amounts of material about a sugya and being able to think about it independently is just to fix in your head, okay, this is the sugya, here are the themes, now I have to figure out which approach I find most convincing to those themes. I find that a very useful way of organizing material. The Brisker mode is a different mode of, right, which enables you to organize the whole issue, right, the commentaries along their conceptual axes. Right, so I'm trying to give you a mode of organizing commentaries along textual axes. And because the longer a sugya gets, the more confusing it is to grasp it as a whole. So I think that it's a worthwhile skill to try and see if you can boil down the commentaries on the sugya as a series of approaches to a discrete number of problems in the text. Right, that's what I was hoping to get out of that, and we'll see as we go through the commentators on the next sugya, we'll see that over and over again you can map them onto each other. We'll even do as an exercise on occasion, it's just take a bunch of Rishonim and rewrite it as one commentary. Because you'll see that 80% of it is exactly the same. They ask the same questions, they get slightly different responses. Their Rosenzweig skill is to study the subtle differences in the formulations of the answers. But even before that, it's just to recognize, right, just to recognize what problems they're responding to. And often you have a fairly limited set of interpretational responses, and then you have a fairly limited set of conceptual developments of those interpretations. Okay, so with that, this sugya and the Rashi and the Tosfot are just the necessary background for understanding the next sugya. So let's move on to the sugya on Daf Mem Bet. Okay, so we begin with a Mishnah that tells you that if you find utensils of some form which have on them a technical term tzura of a chama, a tzura of levona, or a tzura of a darkon, or a drakon, or a dragon, whatever you think it is. Right, so those are yolichem liyam hamelach, which means that they are asur b'hana'a. Right, I'm not going to talk about halachic or etymological disputes about why it is that the metaphor used here for asur hana'a is yolichem liyam hamelach. Rav Moshe ben Gamliel says that it makes a distinction between the kinds of kelim, mechubadin and mevazin. And here again, we'll have the same question we had in the last Mishnah, which is, what is the machloket between Rav Moshe ben Gamliel and the Chachamim? Right, and you have the first option, of course, is that it's simply a machloket in Mitzvot. Do people use avodah zarah symbols on kelim mevuzin as objects of worship or not? You can all immediately think of the question that leads to teku, if that in question is the machloket, which is the parallel to a viadot toa, right? Which is if you have a symbol on toilet paper, right? Is it a surba now because of what is or not, right? And it would be reductio ad absurdum is maybe it was a baal peor image, right? Also, right? So you can play the same game or not. The alternative is that if it's not a machloket in mitzvot, then you have two possibilities. You can turn it into the same machloket as we had in the Rav and the Chachamim, which is that, of course, kelim mevuzin are worshipped less often than kelim mechubadin, and so then we get into a, right, and we can talk it, we can turn it into a chayish lemuta, not chayish lemuta dispute, right, or we can try and come up with some kind of conceptual distinction along the lines that we tentatively proposed for things that are worshipped once a year as opposed to things whose primary purpose is worship. All the options in the Mishnah are structurally identical to the options in the previous Mishnah, although you don't have to make it totally zebizeb because you can always distinguish among kinds of miutim that you're choshesh for under what circumstances, and that's what Tosfot is for. Right, so I mentioned some of you, it's rather, you know, rather interestingly that many areas of Hilchot Kashrut come out of this machloket because lots of Hilchot Kashrut is trying to figure out how you settle the tension between saying that, well, we can just be somech on rov, And the reality is that we don't really like being so mechanrov. It makes people feel uncomfortable to think that 49% of the food they eat is physically traced. Right? It makes you all feel uncomfortable. So that's what, you know, much of Hilchot Kashrut is about trying to negotiate the boundaries between that. In order to resolve that, we develop all sorts of intermediate categories of miut, and all sorts of categories of what kind of exertions is plausible to expect you to engage in to determine whether this is part of the rove or not. Right, that's okay. So we have the Mishnah, and the first line of the Gemara says is Lamemra Tilahani Hu Depolchi Le Lamida Achrine Lo Urimini. So the skill that we started developing last year, which I'm saying without any historical claim about it, is that the role of the Stam literarily is to sew the seams, is to tell you what the connection between positions is, what the connection between texts is. And therefore, if you want to understand what generates conversation in a sugya, is often what did the Stam do when it sewed this seam. So here what you have is a Mishnah and you have this Breita, I guess, right? Ashoche l'shum yamim l'shum na'arot. And that's fine, right? Each of them is independently comprehensible, but you need to accomplish something in order to put them in contradiction or to justify the remini. Right? So if you want to put it from a logical development, first you have the two texts, then you have a claim that the two texts contradict. That's a remini, and then you have an explanation of why those two texts contradict, which is lememra de lahani hu de palchi lehu lemidi achrini lo. That's the right. Those are the logical steps you have to go through. Okay. So what does the right? So the Stam tells you what assumption it sees as necessary in order to put these texts in contradiction. What assumption is that? What assumption do you need to make to put these texts in contradiction? Yeah? Good, so let's tell it to me in English.
Well, that the assumption of the Tanakhama and the Mishnah is that these the things which are in Kilim, that are Asabana, are things that you worship, and presumably there is nothing else that would be worshipped.
In other words, the grounds for the Mishnah's distinction between different kinds of tzurot is that any kli which has a tzura of something which is worshipped is forbidden, right? And any kli which has and any kli which is permitted must the tzura on it must therefore not be worshipped, as opposed to making a claim about these tzurot as they appear on kelim, right? The assumption, right? The contradiction is generated if we assume that symbols are worshipped in whatever context they appear, with the possible exception of Kelim and Buzin, according to Rabbi Shem Ben Gamliel. Right? But any symbol which is worshipped will be presumed to be worshipped if it appears on a Kli, and therefore the object is forbidden. And therefore, if a Kli is permitted, it must be that this is not worshipped.
Well, not that it's presumed to be worshipped on a Kli. We don't know why it's on.
Good. Absolutely right. Even better, right? All we know is that, right? Is right. It's actually more narrowly. All we know is that a kli which has on it, that if a kli is permitted, that must mean that the symbol on it is not worshipped. It might be because it's not worshipped on the kli, or it might be because it's not worshipped at all. Right? We don't actually know that either. Okay. So now, here again, without making chronological claims, right? So we have a statement of Abaye. And the statement of Abaye is apparently a commentary on the Mishnah, and we can now look at the contradiction. Right, the purpose of the contradiction is to enable us to understand why Abaye interpreted the Mishnah in this way. Right, that's what the right Abaye is presented. Right, Abaye is presented by the Gemara as the resolution of this stira. It does, right? Now, we could have interpreted Abai independently and say, you know what, Abai had a masoret, that's all he did, right? Or Abai read the Mishnah and he thought that on internal grounds in the Mishnah this was sufficient. But in the context of the Gemara, we're supposed to understand Abaye as the resolution to this theorem. Right, question? I don't know. I'm not making a chronological claim. I'm pointing out that if you took out the contradiction, right, then you would, right, you could interpret Abaye as that way. So what the Stam does is it tells you that the purpose of Abaye's statement is to resolve a contradiction between this Mishnah and that Braita, as opposed to interpreting the Mishnah on its own grounds. You can. That's a theological position. You can say you can take the position the Stam must have had a masoret and it knew that's what Abaye meant, or not. Right. So I'm not taking a position about that. I'm just explaining literally. That's what the Stam does. Is it explains what the it tells you how to understand Abaye's statement as this, and that's not obvious, because if you just had Abaye's statement, you wouldn't. Right. It wouldn't be obvious to you that was true. That he was responding to a contradiction as opposed to interpreting it in the same way as Rashi. Right, when Rashi tells you things, they're not right. It's always important to understand what Rashi tells you, which is not obvious. Then you can make your own decision whether Rashi figured this out on his own, and if he figured it on his own, is it compelling, or did he have a masoret? If he had a masoret, do you take it as authoritative or not? Right, that's not my issue right now. Okay, yes, you do.
So if you just saw the Mishnah and the Abaye statement on your own,
mm-hmm.
is there another way you might have possibly interpreted it?
I don't know. Let's take a look. Right, for Abaye, right? So now let's try to understand what Abaye's statement is, recognizing that in the context of the Gemara, right, Abaye's statement has to become the resolution of that stira. What I think is going to be is really interesting often is that what's going to discover is that the formulation of the stira is going to affect to change the options you have in understanding Abaye, right? That often the in other words, what I would probably think most interestingly, right, is to say that the Raminhi I might hypothesize that everyone knew that the Abaye was a resolution to this theorem, and then the Lameimra was written to explain to you exactly what the theorem was and how he resolves it. That would be the most interesting thing to me historically.
Well, I mean, I think even without the Uruminu,
yeah.
The Uruminu Mishnah, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what Abaye is clearly talking about, right, is what makes these three things special,
mm-hmm.
right? So okay, if we have to, so we think why is it difficult for him? Right, so how's this? If we were going to put it in some way of making it problematic, why these things are special? The way of asking that is saying, well, look, we have another Mishnah that seems to list all sorts of things, and there's no reason these things necessarily
okay.
should be special.
Could be right. It could be that there's nothing that it result. This doesn't have any results here. Right, I'm just engaging in a reading exercise. Could be it does. Right, let's hold off and see. Okay, so how do you Yedidi, while you're on? So how do you understand what Abaye says?
He's saying these three things are special because they happen to be chashivi.
Well,
so they're right.
Yeah.
They are therefore these are things that are put on vessels such that they would actually be worshipped there. And other things that are on vessels are generally there only there to be pretty.
Uh-huh. So let's start with just the words. What does miflach tachol de mishkechi palchem mean?
So I will admit that I had trouble with this, especially because I wasn't sure whether the hyphens and the semicolon necessarily
sure.
were to
Good.
Be taken on faith.
Excellent.
Coming out with it, I said probably, right? Right, miflach tachol de mishkechei pachei, right? They worship whatever they happen to worship.
Who worships?
The
Avodah Zarah worship whatever they happen to worship.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So therefore, right, that means that obviously what they worship is not restricted to these three things. Okay.
Uh huh.
Now, Meitzar Mufasi, right? What they actually illustrate in worship, right?
Uh huh.
Ahani Tati Dichshivi Tzayiluhu Pasaluhu. Right. These three things that happen to be important, they illustrate and then worship. But as regards other things, Lunoi Ba'alma Ra'abdilu. They only make them for beauty's sake. So I guess those two words in the middle, Meitzer Mefache, would mean something to the effect of, with regards to illustration and worship, right, colon.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I understood it.
So when you say they worship anything they find, except for kelim which they made with other symbols on it, this is what I'm having trouble understanding.
No, so what Mitzvah Tachom Mishka Mefache means is as to do not with the actual vessels themselves, but with the subject matter.
Yeah. So they'll worship.
So what that's talking about, right? So let's say, you don't have to read it with the Mishnah, but right, not just sun, moon, and dragons, but also other things like Jupiter and rivers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Right. But when it comes to things that actually get illustrated in worship, right, only these three things actually they illustrate to worship, and the other things they don't. The other things.
So these are three. These are things that the. So are we talking about a distinction about whether people worship these things when they're on Kalim, or are we talking about the motives of the artisan?
Right.
Is this explaining which kinds of symbols?
We're talking about those two things simultaneously.
But why is it mutter if people worship anything they find? Right. So I made a kli, right, with an image of Jupiter on it.
Well,
I meant it for beauty, but you, the Avodah Zarah, will come along and worship anyway. So what does it matter why I made it?
Right, because I'm not saying l'kol d'mishkechei palchei, I'm not saying that it's something they physically find lying around.
Uh-huh.
Right? L'kol d'mishkechei palchei is everything that they happen to worship. Right? Anything that we find that they worship, right?
Uh-huh. But, so they worship lots of things.
Right.
But these
all
are the only.
They worship lots of things.
But of the things they worship, these are the only things they worship that they think are valuable enough to make ritual objects for.
Right.
Is that how everyone else read it?
I don't think we made a strong distinction. I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, your whole question of Mieser Mefalche, what exactly is it the Yetzira aspect? I don't think we really. I mean, it could be any of those things. It could be that the Yotzer had in mind that he was doing it for Bozara. It could be that people, we're talking about people who worship human-made objects. I don't know that the Gemara is explicit about.
Well, if Abaye's resolution to the Thera, right?
Either way, it's
so right, we have a text which says that people worship constellations, right? And now I have a kli which has on it a picture of a constellation. And Abaye has to tell me why it is that even though I have on here a kli which has on it a picture of something which people worship, this kli is mutter. So why is it mutter?
People worship anything which are God-made things, and created objects are only worshipped if they're one of those three things.
Okay, good. That is an excellent formulation of the two options. Right, one possibility is that, in fact, the fact that people worship things doesn't mean they will worship images of those things, and it's only the sun, the moon, and dragons that people worship images of. And the other is, no, people worship, right, and the ground for in our Mishnah for Is or Heter is whether these things are worshipped. And the second possibility is that, no, we're not worried about whether people worship things, because people worship anything, and if you ban things because people might have worshipped it, you would have to ban everything in the world. Right, so when it comes to a kli, our concern is not whether somebody worshipped it, but whether somebody made it for worship. Right, and there we can just say, you know what, our experience is that that even though people worship all those things, they make secular objects. They make secular objects with emblems of the religious items on them without intending them religiously.
How do you read that in their Bible?
So we say that people worship anything they find, but they only bother to create things for the purpose of worship. Out of these three important things, Meitzar Lamafalchi, right? Right, these are the only things that they make in order, right, as opposed to they make and worship. These are the only things they make in order to worship.
So the Meitzar Lamafalchi is kind of part of the second part already?
Yeah, that's why my brackets were, right? This Rabbi distinguishes between Miflach, that's the bright, right, that's the brighta. People worship, right, anything they find, which, as Miriam points out correctly, can mean they worship anything they find in nature, or they worship anything in, right, anything period. But Meitzar Mefalchi, but making things for the purpose of worship, right, that is limited to these three things. Any other manufactured object, right, is not it is intended solely for beauty, even though it has a religious emblem on it. Okay. Yes, Yuda.
Could it also be that they had different ways of worshiping every idol, and the way you worship these three objects is you drew them on
the fetish? Nice, but it doesn't fit the word chashive.
Right, again.
Right. Now, the other assumption which isn't made explicit is that the list in the Mishnah is exhaustive, right? Because right, the Mishnah says Amoti Chama Kelim Valehem Tzuras Chama Tzuras Levana Tzuras Darkon. Right? If we just change it to Amoti Kelim Valehem Tzuras Chama Tzuras Levana Tzuras Darkon V'chol Kayote Ben, we have an entirely different conversation. Right? To really require two assumptions. Right, to make the contradiction happen, you require the assumption that the ground of Isser in the Mishnah is that these are things which are worshipped, and secondly, you have to make a claim that the ground of Heter, that the Isser in the Mishnah applies only to those things specifically listed. Right, these are all assertions that can be questioned empirically outside of the context of the text, and therefore, if you find a particular commentary who finds it implausible, right? Let's say if you found somebody who says, hang on a sec, I've hung around these worshippers for years, and last I checked, the Jupiter was a lot more important than Diana. And so what are you talking about, telling me the moon is important and Jupiter is not? Doesn't make any sense to me. Right? So such a commentator will find it very hard to read the... To read the Mishnah on the assumption that these are the only three kelim which are chashuv, right? And that's a perfectly legitimate interpretational basis. If you have an external, right, empirical fact that you think the Gemara should have known and seems to be ignoring, then you have to reinterpret it so that it matches that. Yes, Rachel.
So this might be a bit abstract, but I'm just wondering, what about dealing with images of things which you know that they were, by definition, even amongst idol-worshipping cultures, beautiful and therefore worshipped because of hedonistic societies that therefore worship beauty?
Well, who says... Abaya's assumption seems to be they don't worship beauty because making objects for beauty is not religious.
So you're saying that only if it's for a prescribed religious practice.
That's
therefore,
right.
In matter of speaking, whether it's worshipped or not, that's something that we can't keep track of, and it's irrelevant. You're just saying it's actually for a prescribed religious purpose.
Right. When it comes to utensils, right? When it comes to utensils, for all you know, right? I love, you know, let's say this is a story of a joke religion, right? We know where years ago I was in a mixed from and non-from group, but. Somebody called up for room service. Right, one of our hosts called up for room service, but then realized we were in a really from crowd. He didn't want to have us banished from Malachas Shabbos. He was trying to explain to the waiter, this was in Israel, right, what that he wanted room service, but that we couldn't take the elevator down to the kitchen to tell the chef directly what we wanted, and we couldn't sign for delivery. And the waiter was completely befuddled by this. And eventually we explained to him that we belong to this peculiar religion that worship pens and elevator buttons. And so we were unwilling to use that. And that satisfied it. So there might be religions that worship pens and elevator buttons or pots or things like that, right? But we can't tell. Now you might say, make a distinction, okay, if we...
Israel?
I think it was actually Israel. Weird things happen. I think it was. I can't imagine where else I would have been in a private. I think it was. Maybe it was. Where was I? I think it must have been, but maybe I'm wrong. strange things happen. But the so we're willing to, you know, so we understand that we are, for all that we're chayish lemiuta, right? If we don't assume that that the supermarket owner has worshipped the plastic spoons before they put them on the shelf. Even if you know, plastic spoons were lava lamps, for that matter, right? Which I tell you, people worship lava lamps. What can I do? Hold on one second. Okay. Now then, we extend it to say, right? This is more the chiddush of the way we're understanding the Mishnah, that we don't even make that presumption about objects that have religious symbols on them. Right? We only worry about a particular set of symbols which we assume were manufactured. Right, that if they were placed on objects, they must have been manufactured for religious purposes, because people wouldn't use these symbols except for religious purposes. They're too important. That's what it sounds like. But the outcome is, you should be able to buy kalim which have symbols of all the constellations, even in a zodiacal culture, as long as it doesn't have a sun and moon. And that's what the impression seems to be, because we all understand. Yeah, you know, the issue I have is I have a tie which probably has the goddess of justice on it, Athena. Right. So can I have a tie with Athena on it? Right, nobody believes it. I can't promise that there aren't some, you know, Greek worshippers around there not bowing down to it, right? Probably an image of Athena. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? Okay, yes, Sharon.
That theoretical commentator that you made reference to before that knows that Jupiter is worshipped more than the moon, Diana?
Yeah.
How would that commentator read the Gemara? The Ramin, he is based on the premise that the list is exhaustive. Like, how would...
No, it could just be that things like it means manufactured object, means celestial objects, but rivers, right? Rivers is too much. So the contradiction only resolves around the Shum Yamim. But of course, Mazalot would overlap.
Okay.
All right, that's how we would do it. Okay, yes, Miriam.
If you were to take the theoretical commentator, I don't know about it in this case,
In general, traditional commentators will not explicitly reject the Gemara. The whole dispute about whether the Rambam will paskin that way, as opposed to interpret it that way. Right? Whether the Rambam and other early Sephardi commentators, Sephardi paskim, are willing to take what their pshat in Memras and Brises against the Stam. Right? There are cases where it seems evident, but you can try and exclude it to narrow categories like that. But you might very, very happily, even in Ashkenaz, say, oh look, you know, there's a machloket sugyot, because over there in that sugyot, it doesn't make any claims that it means this. Right? So just the recognition of an alternative interpretation often liberates you to understand it differently somewhere else. Right, whereas if you assume that the reason it says this is because it means it, so then you're going to say, "Oh, look, we have a contradiction, right? How could it?" But you don't have. But once you recognize that it's not inherent in the text, then it liberates you. Okay, this sogi understands it this way, and that sogi understands it. That sogi understands it that way.
So in the case of the signals they get, it would be fair that any post-Talmudic commentator would use their own understanding of the over the Gemara.
With the possible exception of the Rif and the Rambam. That's a huge, huge controversy, right? You know, first we have to find out how often is the Pashup shot, quote unquote Pashup shot, against the Gemara, right? Right. So it's only a subset of those cases, right? You have to find a set of cases where there is an interpretation that can plausibly be seen as clearer than the Gemara that can't possibly be read into the Gemara. Right. That's a fairly small subset. Right. In those subsets, it might be the Rambam does it 100% of the time, but we don't know how large the set is. Okay, then, as I say, it's the whole people. Maybe the Rambam only does it when he thinks that the Stam here is written by the Saboraim as opposed to the Amoraim. Right, all sorts of things like that. I'm not taking my purpose right now is just to recognize that, right, it's just to not presume that the text has to be, on, that a that a cited text has to mean the same thing everywhere.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah. You can read, you know, the original Meir Simchel Feldblum wrote his thesis on this one way, and David, Professor David Sykes wrote a thesis another way on this. There's a whole bunch of theses on this issue specifically. And then, as opposed to that, you have B.Z. Benedict's, right, the Harama. Meir Simchel Feldblum, Allah Shalom, I think, right? Yeah? I think it was mentioned about a year and a half ago. Professor David Schatz and Ben Sion Benedict, HaRambam Lelosti Ami HaTalmud, right? He's the response to all those positions. And she explains how the Rambam really never goes against the Gemara at all. Okay, at least that is the literature as of 20 years ago, which is the last time. Right, I knew anything about it. I'm sure that some of you can give you more updated literature. Maybe there have been 5 theses since, I don't know. That's what, 20 years ago, that's what I know. Okay. So then we get onto this statement of Mankid Rav Sheshet Chumrei Matneyata Vitani. So, Adina, how did you understand that line?
We had several different
understandings. Uh-huh.
Well, first we thought it meant that he was more machmir than the Mishnah.
Uh-huh.
Which didn't jive well with how the Gemara continued.
Uh-huh.
Because if all of our changes was doing was being more machmir than the Mishnah, so then why was the Gemara really bothered by it?
Mm-hmm.
So then it was suggested that he had been had somehow learned his chumrah from the Mishnah.
Okay.
Which is interesting because the Mishnah seems like very exacting.
Which Mishnah?
This Mishnah for this Gemara.
This Mishnah for this Gemara.
Yeah.
So you think Rosh Hashanah relates to this Mishnah?
Yeah.
Okay. So anybody else have either a different shot in Chumrei Matniyata or a different context for Rosh Hashanah? Yes, Rachel.
Well, I think we believed that it related to the Mishnah, but we also thought that the Parsufim part was a bit unrelated because the
he discussed Mansheva
and he wrote, and we were discussing Chama Levana and Drakon, but then Chutzmi Partu Badam, that whole part was a reference to a previous discussion that was not in this discussion.
Uh-huh, where was it?
It was, I think, in one,
continues from that. Yeah, so it's the introduction.
It continues from now, but it's the first time that it's appearing. This particular Mishnah itself did not bring up that issue.
Uh-huh. So we don't know where he got parts of it from.
Right.
We don't really know
where it was his specific verses. Yeah.
Okay. So we don't, right, and that leads to the question, so we don't know what Chumrei means then because he's not getting it from this text. Okay, anybody have another shot in what Chumrei Matneyata means? Okay, yes, you did, yeah.
It might mean the most chamur examples of categories as found in various Mishnayot.
Aha! Uh-huh. So he collected, right? So this is Rosh Hashanah's greatest chumra hits.
Right.
Various bright hits.
Not the chumra of the din, but the most chumra examples. That is the Chama Levana is the most chumra of Matalot, and Adam is the most chumra of Partzufin.
Aha. Uh-huh. Because you understand
these
the
are not really chumra, right? It's a pretty... It's
right,
pretty
the problem is, right, if you like the chumras, right, everybody should begin their chumras by saying, kol mutarei kud. Okay, good. So, you can look at the Rishonim later and see, right, the two basic options people came up with. Yeah, Mary, you got another one? Yeah?
No, I just had a question.
Mm-hmm.
Is this line assumed to be part of what Rav Sheshet says, and if not, is it possible that the Gemara rejects this line later on?
Well, it's possible the Gemara rejects it even as Rosh Hashanah, but...
Rejects it as changing its mind that Rosh Hashanah isn't
If you think Rosh Hashanah didn't say it, we should say something like Ela Yid Idmar Hachi Idmar.
Well, no, the Tani would be what Rosh Hashanah says, so...
Yeah.
So the question is, did Rosh Hashanah realize he was making Chumrei Matnita, whatever that means? Was that his intention, or was the Gemara understood his intention?
Aha, is that the Gemara? That's an interesting question.
If it was what the Gemara assumed,
yeah.
Can it be that the Gemara rejects it?
Reject this assumption that he's coming from the text.
I guess reading Chumrei Matnita being the first way that Adina said of being more chumra than the Mishnah, even if it doesn't work with the continuation of the Gemara, it wouldn't matter because we would just say that the Gemara rejects that when it...
I think it would have to tell us. If it rejects something, it has to tell us. That would be my instinct. Mm-hmm. Emily, you had a question? Okay, so I'm just going to point out that from a literary perspective, what does Rosh Hashanah comment on? Comments on the first Mishnah, doesn't he? Kol ha'tzlamin asurin, but kol ha'mazalot mutarin, kol ha'pratufin mutarin, and kol ha'tzuras mutarin. Right, so not clear to me that Rosh Hashanah has to be read as having made a statement about this part of our Mishnah.
Good.
Yeah, I'm not telling you. I don't know what the word chumre means yet. Right. I don't know the chumre has anything to do with stringency. Chumre might just mean material.
You just like the word kol, kind of.
I like the kol blank, right? Kol ha blank halacha x.
Well, the one's
Asturian,
and then.
Yeah, kol ha Asturian, but kol ha mazalos Asturian, the kol ha pratuf is Asturian, the kol ha pratuf is Asturian, the kol ha tzuras Asturian. Right, that's the literary frame. On the other hand, you can read him as a commentary on this Mishnah by saying that he's telling you that, right, that. When we say Tzuras Chama and Tzuras Levana and Tzuras Darkon, so that tells you Tzuras Chama and Tzuras Levana at the exclusion of the other mazalot, Darkon as opposed to the exclusion of every other tzura, and then we have the problem, right, that Rachel pointed out is that we don't have a precedent for the category of partzuf. All right, that's really underlying issue. Yes, sir.
I still don't have a clear concept as to what the distinction is between all these categories.
That's true. We don't have any idea what the difference between these categories is.
Okay, and there certainly seems to be overlap. Like, here they're talking about mazalot, and they talk about chama and levana, but then later, I think, it says kol mazal.
Right, here it's a mazal, but in the Mishnah, it's a tzura of the chama, a tzura levana.
Right.
Yes, right, so right, it would be neater if he had said, but we have to wonder why didn't he say kol tzurot mutarot chutz mi tzurot mazalot shel chama levana v'darkon, right? V'tzurat darkon, right? That would tie it together, but it would be sloppy, right? This is a nice three-part memorizable formula. So maybe that's the only reason he did it. But sure, right? He called them mazalot, but the Mishnah says there are tzurot of those mazalot. So how can he say, right? So if you read him literally, and that's right, you have to say kol tzurot mutarot, including the tzurat chama and the tzurat levana, but that seems to contradict our Mishnah, so right, so we're in trouble. And it's not clear that whatever it meant in the original time of Gemara, it's not clear that, or in the Mishnah, that it's not clear that anybody subsequent really ever keeps those categories straight. What is a tzura, what is a partzuf, what is a mazal, what is a tavnit, what is a dmut, right, all these terms. And the problem, this I learned from Professor Neil Danzig when we were doing a study of various kinds of bowing, I believe, is that often these terms are meant very distinct by different groups, but mean different things. And then when somebody tries to read these two texts together, then the whole thing goes bluey. That may have happened here. Okay, so moving on, so Amar Mar, which presumably means Rosh Hashanah. Kol ha-mazalot mutarin chutz mi-mazal chama levana. Right. So now we engage in a long anonymous setup, which is designed to introduce a machloket which occurs several times in Shas between Abaye and Rava which Abai and Rava are generally very consistent in their position. I think there's one place that may be reversed. I think they're generally consistent in which Abai is willing to take a text and right and break it up and claim it, right, and claim that that different parts of the text are talking about different contexts, and Rava generally thinks that that's cheating. I think that that's the exception. You have to look it up, and maybe this was, I don't remember if this was the exception, and generally they say the other way. But I think that this is a, at the very least we can say this is a common machloket Abai and Rava, and about whether text can be interpreted in this fashion. Okay? So that we have prior to that is an explanation of what could have driven Abaye to make this claim, and driven Rava alternatively to make the claim that the middle section of Rav Sheshes must be according to a particular mandamar. Yes.
So, I mean, this is a common, as you mentioned, yeah, it's a common type of distinction to make. So according to Abaye in this reading, does he think he's being truthful to the intention of the original author of the text?
Why not?
Okay. I mean, in a more general question, whenever there's an encimto which is very, very specific with very minimal literary basis for that interpretation, outside of the logic which made you arrive at that conclusion, does it bother them that might not have been the original?
Good. So that's why it's useful to think this way, right? Because actually, I think okimtos are almost always really the intent of the text. And we have to understand is that because we read it as if this is the answer to that question. But more often, the question was devised to explain how the okimta happened.
Okay.
But the okimta pre-exists. Okay, I'll give you, this is my parade example from, right, again, we always teach the Kvod HaBriot Sugya. Right, so you have so the Sugya goes like this, right, you have Amar of Yehuda, right, Hamotzi Kilayim Bevigdo, or Beveged Chaviro, depending which gears you have, Poshana Filo Bechutz, right, if you find yourself wearing shatnez, or your friend wearing shatnez, you tear the clothing off, you're in the marketplace. Series of Kushya, right, the third Kushya is Tashma, Gadol Kvod HaBriot Shedochel Lo Tasei Shabbatorah. Okay. Ooh, look. Right. How could he claim that you? Right? Obviously, this contradicts Rav Yudamarav's premise. Right. Tirgama Rav Kahana, or Tirgama, no, Tirgama Rav somebody in front of Rav Kahana, Bilav de Los Sasser. It's only talking about Los Sasser, which means it's only talking about the Rabbanans, right? And they laugh at him, and they say, Los Sasser is deraisa also, right? The whole question what that means, and they say, don't laugh at him, all the Rabbanans are Los Sasser. Right? So normally you teach this, and you say, oh, look. Right. Look at this wild okimta he came up to. Right. He came up to. He said, "Gadol kvod habriyot shadoka lo tasei shabatorah means lo tasor." Ha. That's the Gemara's reaction, right? And so you say, "Oh, look, they came up with this wild okimta in order to respond to Yehuda Marav, to save Yehuda Marav." No, tirgama always means that we're not quoting a live conversation. We're quoting an okimta that somebody made somewhere else. He had already explained this. Right. So it's the kushya that's made up, not the teres. Right, and that is very often the case that we know the okimta, and then we construct the question to make you right to make the okimta look necessary. But really, the okimta preexisted. We have no idea why Rav Kahana said it. Probably, I guess he would say it because it says Gadol Kvod HaBriyot Shedocha Et Lo Tasei Shabbatorah. It doesn't say Shedocha Kol Lo Tasei Shabbatorah. So you have to explain which Lo Tasei is unique. Right, that's what I would think, right? But you can do it many, many times, right? That right, okimtas that are presented as right, are presented in the Gemara as responses to pressure externally, are really internal thing. Reading, if you look closely, you'll discover. In that sugya, the other example I give in that sugya is the first question of sugya, where the Gemara says, you're back from the funeral. And lifnehem lifnehem shtei drachim achat shchat tmeya veachat teora babet tmeya, right? So we pray the Gemara. So you can follow the mourner. You can follow the mourner if you're a kohen. You can follow the mourner even through the tamei path. And the Gemara says, that contradicts him also. The answer is no. That's talking about a beta pras. Ha! Where they get this crazy idea of the beta pras? So I think it's pashut. Why is the brisa talking about the way back from the funeral? If kvod habrios is right. If Kvod HaBriyot is docha alotase deraisa, you should be able to go to the funeral. So you have to ask the question, why is it plausible? Why does the Braita construct the way back as opposed to just say that going to go to the funeral? The answer is it must be different. A difference is not because of kavod. It's more kavod to go to the funeral than to walk the mourner back. Whereas the answer is there must be some kind of tumma that you experience on a path that you don't experience in a cemetery and we're home free.
So either from an omitted statement, which would have made more sense, or from the language of the
Braita. Right, all sorts of Braita, I say, but there can't be... Right. It might not be that shot in the Braita. It might be that that it's all a text error. It might be that the Braita believes that Kvod HaChaim is more important than Kvod HaMeit. There are all sorts of independent interpretations. But the Okimta was not developed to save Rav Yehuda Marav.
Okay.
Right, that's my point. Very often. Very often, I think that I make this point because often kids lose their faith in Gemara because teachers present the Okimta as if it is only a response to the Kushya, and that seems really implausible. And I think it's very rarely true. That's why it's important to recognize that often the Stam is a reconstruction of the problem.
Are there any textual clues that tell you if it's...
In this case?
In general, that tell you which one came first.
No, this is, you can write many doctorates about it. Right? No, some people assume that the Stam came first, that the Stam is early, and some people assume the Stam is late, and some people assume the Stam is all along. I tend to think, right, so to me the core of this is to recognize that the Gemara is written late. And so the specific formulation of the Stam is late, but that doesn't tell you anything about when the content was developed. Right? So I don't think you can ever tell you. The literary formulation will always be late. When the content came about, you don't know. Because often it's obvious, right? The reason he said this is because he asked the question, what's the reason? Now, did he ask the question, what's the reason, is my Tama? I don't know if he used those words. That's a formulaic said. Did somebody formulate him as my Tama X? I have no way of knowing that. But understand what's going on in the sugya, it's often useful to recognize, right, to see the Stam as the frame, right, to explain why the Amora happened as opposed to see the Amora as responding to the Stam. Okay, yes, Emma? Yeah?
I wasn't raising my hand, but I
Sure, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
And then the Stam / narrator, whatever that is, brings in an already existent Amorite statement that may have occurred in a different context.
Mm-hmm.
But then that sounds like something, like the example that you brought with the Kever, whatever, the long way back. Like, that's taking a statement that occurred in a different context and using it to argue in this context. Which, I mean, there may not be something wrong with that, but like, I don't know. It's like, it's not like this was the conversation that happened and like you can, analyze it as like, okay, this is the halakha conversation and let's move forward as trying to like pick halakha out of it. It's more like creating a conversation that didn't exist based on statements that existed in their isolated conversation.
Yeah, so this assumes that we're not, that the Gemara is not the tisma verba, right? It's not the live minutes of an actual conversation. But since it takes place over hundreds of years, it's kind of hard to believe it's a live conversation with all the parties engaging in it.
Right, but like, I guess I'd be more comfortable if it was like, okay, we had records of, let's say, three different conversations that were discussing, like, the status of the Sarah Halab, and then you just, like, pull the three of them together from three different records and conversations to explain three different opinions. But that's not what it sounds like you're saying.
Okay, this probably is a broader kind of, we'll talk about it next Wednesday night. No, it's not a question. Sorry, you could ask that. What I would just say in shorthand is conversations go on for a really long time. Right? They go on for days, they go on over years. Right? So let's suppose you were in charge of constructing the conversation. Right? You were supposed to provide the official record of the conversation in Yeshiva University about whether you have to face Mizrach when davening. Now, this conversation takes place over 100 years with many different rabbis, but you have to present it in a memorizable fashion. Right, so to do that, you'll pull in conversation all over, and your job is to create that conversation. Now, that conversation has happened organically. It might be that you're working on drafts that other people have prepared and all that, but right, it might be at the end you have to say, you'll discover that, hey, guess what? This Rosh Hashiva nobody ever heard of, right? Then let's suppose you think all along, right, all along your life you wondered, like, why is it that this little classroom in room 101 faces east? as opposed to, right? You may never even have known that there was a little classroom minion in, right, in town. You know the story, right? So why does classroom and minion exist in Room 101? So, you should know for many years in NYU, right, the main auditorium faced north, the main midrash faced north, the main auditorium faced west, and there was this little classroom, the minion in Reuben faced east, as was this little classroom in Room 101, and there was one, I think, Mork Shul faced south. So, right, and there were all conversations about this and how you daven in Shul, right, which, you know, in my own life, I can tell you that when I was in NYU, everyone davened facing the Aron, which was west, except for David Lifshitz, David Lifshitz davened facing northeast. When they first rebuilt the Beit Midrash, they put a diagonal wall in front of David Lifshitz, so that he wouldn't look like he was facing differently, right? But they cut off the corner so that he could daven facing northeast without looking like he was doing anything other than facing the wall. And then over time, right, positions changed, and so you started having these deep inconveniences because half the people were davening this way, and half the people were davening this way. You try to take three steps back, and it was tripping, falling over. And also, it looks like classic lunge is going to do, right? So over time, right, the center of gravity has moved towards, right, after everyone davening sideways until eventually they built a new baby drosh, which you get the face, right? Everyone faces these. But Rabbi Willick told us that the reason there's this little classroom minion, Davin Nusach Sfard, which happens to be the minion I grew up in, my father still goes there, Nusach Sfard minion in YU Davening East, is that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, when he came to YU, saw the Beit Midrash facing north and said, "Ack!" But he didn't want to, you know, say that the Sasser Daf in the Beit Midrash. So he pretended that he had been Rav of a Hasidic Shtibel in Europe, and he wanted a Nusach Sfard minion. So he started a Nusach Sfard minion, which faced east, in which he davened Nusach Ashkenaz. That's what Rabbi Willick told us. Now, you discover this now, right? All of a sudden, you have to rewrite the conversation. Now, you can rewrite the conversation in lots of ways. You can say, and then Rabbi Clapper told me this interesting story, or you can try and fit in when it happened 40 years ago, but it wasn't part of the conversation then, so you're going to have to rewrite it. Right, that would be the way that's what I'm talking about. When you get new information about the past, right, that you can't make it part of the live conversation because it isn't part of the conversation that developed. So you have to make a choice. And I think that's right, because you get 100 words to summarize 100 years of conversation. Right, they didn't talk in this clipped form. Right, this was a job. Somebody's job was to summarize the whole conversation into memorizable form. Okay. Yes. Ezra, you have a question? Mary, you have a question? Well, I'm not changing the reading of the text right now. All I'm telling you is that it is a way of literarily framing the text. The text doesn't tell you anything about itself being live. The text presents a question and answer. Right? It doesn't tell you, right? Right? That tells you that in the context of this text, this is the answer to that question. Right? That there's nothing in the text which tells you one or the other whether the answer existed before the question or not. And literarily...
Well, it could be relevant to how you understand the answer.
Could be. Right? I don't know. At this point, I have no... We could talk about manuscript evidence. We could talk about, right? But mostly I'm interested in just making you realize that the Rishon, that understanding that, right, understanding that the answer, right, that you can think about it as what question is this answering as opposed to what question is this the answer to? Sorry, that's not definitely different. So the thinking that the only way to understand the answer is by saying, okay, this is the question, this is what it must be, or alternatively saying, look, this is the answer, now let's try to go back and figure out what question could this be the answer, right? Could this be the answer to? Is something I think the Rishonim do. And you'll see how sometimes they change pshat in the question, and sometimes they change pshat in the answer, depending on whether they're more convinced by their pshat in the question or their pshat in the answer. So it helps free you to understand why they make the interpretational choices you do if you recognize that they have it right, that you can think about the way that you can think about the sugya starting from the answer and then reconstructing the question. And also, there are times when the Rishonim will tell you, you know what, that's not a good question, it's not a good step then, but who cares? We all know what we're trying to get to. Right, Rishonim will do that.
But I mean, I guess that assumption that the whole assumption that the answer predates the question.
Mm-hmm. The answer predates the form of the question. The answer was developed for some reason. Right? We'll spend a week talking about it. It's fine. And this is useful for me because this is what I'm going to talk about next Wednesday night. Right now, I'm really just trying to give you a very traditional mode of reading, and just to recognize that it's useful to separate the Gemara into its components, as opposed to just assuming that it's supposed to be read. The metaphor, the broader metaphor I give students is that if you think of a sugya as a literary whole, as opposed to as a sequence constructed, so the sharp way I frame it, as opposed to which it has to be because it's supposed to be memorized, it's supposed to be a whole. So the sharp metaphor the other way is to thinking of the Gemara in order is like watching television one pixel at a time. You never see the picture, right? You just follow. Look, first this blip comes, and this stop, then this stop, then this stop, this stop, this stop. But really, sugyas are holes. Right? They're attempts to encapsulate an entire conversation. Now, that's what I want to argue. That's the broad argument. Is all you always have to think at the end of the sugya, what did I learn? Not what did I learn at this point, this one, this point. What did I learn as a whole of the sugya? And that forces you to pay attention to where the breaks are, right? So really, what I want you to get out of this is, so the way to think of this whole unit is first we have a conversation about, right, which is built around the Baye, which tries to understand why does the Mishnah think that only these surot are forbidden? Right, why are these surot unique? They're not religious. They don't seem to us to be religiously unique. Right, we know people worship all sorts of things. The response to that is some kind of claim that they are religiously unique. The problem with that is that even that claim won't hold up empirically often. Right? So the problem that all the commentators are going to have to figure out is, since it doesn't seem plausible to them historically that in fact only the Chama Levana and Darkon were important because they know what the culture was and people worship other things, so how do you interpret a claim that only these things are worshipped in that way when it doesn't seem to be right, when it doesn't seem to be true? Right? But fundamentally, what everyone has to deal with is, how do I deal with a Mishnah which says, Alehem Tzurat Chama Tzurat Levana Tzurat Darkon is unique? Right? That's the theme that everyone has to address, is what could possibly be unique about those three? You have two ways of doing it. You can make claims, plausible or not, about those three being unique, or you can claim that those three represent categories, or you can claim that those three are only addressing a particularly narrow band. Right, there's a narrow band of things, and in that narrow band, only those three things are forbidden. Okay, but there's a whole other band. Let's say the Partsuf band, which everything else is forbidden. Okay, then we have a claim. Then we have a claim by Rosh Sheshet, and we don't know where this. Right, this is the problem of Rosh Sheshet is we don't know what he's interpreting. Right, so I offered you the possibility, right? And we don't, right? He's doing something, right, which is called mankit chumre, right? Which regrettably has no analogs anywhere. Nobody else is mankit chumre anywhere, so we're all making it up, or we have a masorah, whichever way you want it. But unfortunately, there are two conflicting masorah at least, so we're still stuck in the middle, right? Somebody is mankit chumre and produces a text which makes extravagant halachic claims. Right, at the end of which, if we read this text where we read the Mishnah, anything that doesn't involve a sun, a moon, a person, or a dragon is mutter, period. Well, we don't know what Rosh Sheshet is talking about Kli's. Right? Right, the most radical, right? And if he's talking about Kli's, so where did he get person from? Right? So you could read the Mishnah and say, what he's reading the Mishnah is saying, of all non-human figures, everything except the Chama Levana and Darkon is, right? That's a plausible way of reading it. We don't know that for sure. Right? As I say, we could be reading him, right? Just as a gloss on the opening Mishnah, right, in which we say he's telling everything but tfamim. Tfamim, of course, we know are forbidden, but not these things, right? So we don't know, right? We don't know what the context of that statement are, right? Which I would frame it with the conversation before is. So here, okay. So here's the. What I'm actually trying to take is a very frum position, which is that Gemara is incomprehensible without Masoret. Right? Oral texts are incomprehensible without Masoret. So the Stam is necessary. And the way you can see how necessary the Stam is because when the Stam lets us down, right, we're gone. We have no idea what Rosh Hashanah is talking about. Because the Stam didn't tell us. Or if it did, we lost what the words meant. The statement itself doesn't talk for it. Doesn't talk for us. Right, so we have to be aware, right, that what we have is an oral text. Oral texts were never expected to be understood without a Masoret. We don't have that Masoret, so we're stuck. Or we're liberated, whichever way you want to look at it. Right, we can make it mean whatever we want, because no one can tell us otherwise. Or we can make it mean whatever the Rishonim want, right, if we want to be narrower about that. Okay, what we also got out of Abaye was Abaye introduced a new bifurcation, which is that he distinguished between objects that were made or objects that were intended religiously and objects that were intended artistically, right, intended for beauty. Right, so we have a category in Abaye of objects with religious symbolism or with potentially religious symbolism that are nonetheless permitted because they are for the sake of art or beauty. Now it might be that noi is just a category of things other than worship, or it might be that noi is its own meaningful category. Right? We don't know the answer to that either. But Abaye at least opens up the possibility that the content of the image is less important than the intent of the image. You know, let's take the case that Emily was talking about yesterday. My name is Asher Lev, where at the end an artist uses a crucifixion as a symbol of ultimate suffering. So is it Asher to paint the crucifixion as a symbol of ultimate suffering if you don't intend it to be worshipped? Right? Or is it Asher to put images of the muses at the right on the frontispiece of a sefer? Right? Might be. I don't mean to worship the muses. The muses are just a metaphor, right? I've read Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost begins with an invocation to the muses. It doesn't mean that Milton was a pagan. Yes?
But the example of the crucifix where you're saying that it's, okay, look at this as a symbol of ultimate suffering, like, I would say that that's even a little bit different than something that's just for the sake of beauty. This is giving it some kind of, like, theological / I don't know, like, mashma'ut is, like, the word that I'm thinking of, as opposed to something that maybe is like a pagan image of a sun that you happen to think like matches well with your kitchen and like looks nice.
Good. So that's the methodological aspect. The methodological point that I'm trying to make broadly is this. And this is important for understanding what Tosfa does all the time. What Tosfa and the Gemara do all the time is they say, I have two texts that contradict each other. I have two categories into which will enable me to separate them. But that doesn't mean that we don't know whether the boundaries they're giving you is this category goes up to this example, this category goes to this example, or they're giving you typical examples, mm-hmm. and there's really a huge space in the middle which is left to you to determine, or they're even giving you extreme examples. So we know that utensils made of religious symbols, right, assuming we take that interpretation of Abaye, the utensils made for the purpose of being worshipped are forbidden. And utensils made for the purpose of mere decoration are permitted. You're right, it's an in-between category, which is utensils made for the sake of the substantive content of the religion without the belief structure.
That's a much smarter way of saying
that. Right? We don't know, right? That's one, right? We don't know, right? We don't know if you can do that, right? If instead of my picture of Athena being there because I think that picture of Athena matches my colors, because I really want to have a symbol of wisdom, but in no way do I believe that this, right, that wisdom actually comes from any source other than the one God. Right? So we don't know. Right? I don't know whether noi is a category meaning anything other than religion, right? Or noise, right? Or noise a category, meaning only decoration as opposed to everything else. And you can think of intermediate categories, obviously. You can think of live religions and dead religions, right? And noxious content as opposed to content we approve of. But yeah, the problem is, right, can you draw little horns on, right? On, right? Right? And if you can't draw them, can you pass out Dilbert cartoons? And if you pass out Dilbert cartoons, is it only, right, is it enough of a shinoi instead of having a guy with...
Dilbert cartoons because of the boss?
No, well, because of Phil.
Phil.
In Dilbert cartoons, the character is Phil, the Prince of Hex.
Oh, wait, Phil. Has the weird...
The boss has that, but the character called Phil, the Prince of Insufficient Light, who darns you to heck, and he wanders around carrying a spoon instead of a fork. and so is that the inappropriate use of Christian imagery? Everybody knows when you look at it, you see a spoon, because it's supposed to be a fork, because really that means it means Prince of Darkness, all right? Or just say, no, it's making fun of it, right? What about parodies? Right? We haven't even begun to address the question of whether you can parody. Okay, so then we move on to wherever Rav Sheshet came from. We move into a discussion of Rav Sheshet. So we've talked about how the form of that discussion is an introduction to the machloket of Abaye and Rava, followed by a braita which is intended to explain Rava's position. Now, as it happened, in the context of that discussion of Rav Sheshet, we have a new text introduced, right? So we have Rav Sheshet's text. We have the text of Hamotzi Kelim. That's the Mishnah we have here. But we also have twice drushas introduced of Lo Ta'asuniti. Right? Nobody in the Gemara has explicitly referenced Lo Ta'asuniti. No, right? No named character in the Gemara references Lo Ta'asuniti. It's introduced here as the background, right? As the background to Abaye. Now the first one is one that is familiar to us already, which is Lo Ta'asuniti, Lo Ta'asun Kidmut Shamshi Hamishamshin Lefanai Bamarom. Right? And that makes sense to us. That's a sugya that is. That's a statement familiar to us, although we all know the controversy about whether Marom includes Mazalot or not. Right? And then we have we've already seen that in the Mechilta. We have a new drasha, which says, Lo ta'asuni ti elohei chesed v'lehi zahav, hani in surat darkon lo. What does that mean? Right? What drasha are we making from E.T. which excludes a darkon? Sounds like it could be. But why can't I make a dark kind of gold?
Meaning out of the Elohe piece of that.
So a dark cone is not a god? That's the claim?
Not in the same sense, but whatever else you might be thinking about it.
Could be. Or it could be a dark cone is not E.T.
Yeah.
Right? We don't know. Okay, but this is the first introduction in this sugya of those drashot. Okay, then, right, then having finished the discussion of Rav Sheshet, we have a new Mishnah introduced, which is the Mishnah of Rabban Gamliel. Okay, the Mishnah of Rabban Gamliel has not been referenced in any of the previous discussions. No one makes an effort to integrate the discussion of Rabban Gamliel with the discussion of either of the previous two Mishnayos. The discussion of Rabban Gamliel takes place entirely on the realm of how do you square him with the drasha of Lo Ta'asuniti. Yes?
Did you put the dot because it was like a different dot or because like there was stuff there that you put out?
The dots?
Yeah.
Which three dots?
Between those two.
Yeah.
Probably I took stuff out. Yeah. I took out the sugya which addresses what constitutes a dragon. And what constitutes Mechubadin and Mevuzin.
Okay,
right? But, right, so really now what you have is you have three different sugyot addressing what kind of generic term for a thing other than the thing itself is forbidden. Right? What kind of tselem, partsuf, dmut, tzura, mazal, andarte, right, is forbidden. And what I want you to get is that there are points of overlap between the sugyot, but nobody in the Gemara makes an effort to integrate them. Right? Nobody quotes Rav Sheshet in the conversation of Rabban Gamliel. Nobody quotes Rabban Gamliel in the conversation of the Mishnah. Nobody quotes this Mishnah in the context of Kol Tzlamim. But we, halachically, have to do this. Now we can make the presumption that if the Gemara didn't integrate these sugyot, then each of these sugyot must be talking about a different axis. Right, and so we're going to have to construct three different universes. Let's say the universe of making objects, and the universe of finding objects, right, and the universe of buying objects. Right, we could do that. Or we could assume that, you know what, none of these conversations was intended to be comprehensive. They're records of different conversations that took place in different Batei Midrash. But halachically, we have to find some way of, right, we have to find a way of integrating them. Or it could be that we see our job as choosing between them. Right? So in a sense, what we're trying to do is the job of the person who put the sugya together. Right? 1,000 years later, we have to create a new sugya which integrates all of them. And that's what the Rishonim are doing. Right? When the Rishonim make halachic decisions, they're doing that. When they make interpretational decisions, they have choices. They can choose to interpret them independently and not bother to integrate them. Okay? Yes, Rachel.
I'm just wondering, is there any way for us to take an educated guess as to why the Psalms of the Gemara is not integrating the conversation? No.
Or less educated. More or less educated. Now, in addition to that, we have a specific structural problem in the third sugya, is that the flow is very hard to get, because Abaye makes three different statements, and then we have an additional statement quoted from Rav Yehuda Breit Rav Yoshua, you have a set of Tanaitic drashot and lota asuniti, you have a set of Amoraic statements by Abaye, and then you have one statement by an Amora, which makes a new drasha on lotasuniti. Right, that's the raw materials of this sugya. The problem is we are not told whether the statements of Abaye are sequential. Right, meaning Abaye made this one, then he made that one turned out to be incompatible, so he made this one. Or whether we're supposed to see Abaye as making a series of statements which interpret each of the drashot of lotasuniti. So at the end, we can have a collection of compatible drashot and lotas, right? Really, you can view each of the drashot as contradictory also, right? First we thought lotas uniti meant that. Then we thought lotas uniti meant that. Then we thought lotas uniti meant that, right? Or we can view them as lotas uniti means each of these things, and we can say Abaye, first he said that, then he said that, and then he said that. Or we can say no. Abaye, right? Abaye, really, if we were to take this stam out of this sugya, what would emerge is a set of drashot, each of which comes with a commentary by Abaye. And that will obviously change the sugya halachically dramatically, whether the end goal is to maintain each of Abaye's positions, or the end goal is to maintain only the end of Abaye's positions. Then we can ask ourselves whether Abaye's positions here depend or don't depend on Abaye's position in the previous sugya. Right? How would Rava, who read differently in the previous sugya, how would you read all of these statements? Whether the Bechot Abaye and Rava has implications for understanding of each of the Mishnah, of each of the other Mishnayot directly, right? Each of the Machlokot has to be played out through every other text, and each of our options in interpreting this sugya has to be played out through each other text, right? Is it assumed that Abaye agrees with everything Rav Sheshet said, so that we could actually try and have a lineup? But look, Rav Sheshet said three things. There are three drashot to Asuniti. Abaye said three things. Yay! Right? That would be a really neat system. Okay, that's what the job of constructing the halacha out of this sugya is. Right, deciding how to envision the relationship between the sugyot, and how to envision the relationship between Abaye and the brightot in the last sugya, and how to envision the relationship between the statements of Abaye in that sugya. So the last thing we'll just say, right, what's the key marker that's missing in the sugya if it's supposed to be a sequential sugya? All we should get, right, there's one word.
Ella.
Right, the one word is Ella. Right, it's all they're showing to pick up, that it doesn't say Ella Amar Abaye, it says, right, it just says, each time it says Abaye Amar. On the other hand, it looks like Abaye gets disproven left and right. We'll have to figure that out. Okay, so that's where we will pick up, my guess is that we won't have Shir on the Gemara tomorrow, so we'll give you tomorrow and Monday to finish this, right, to finish all the Makorot in this unit, and then I'll go back to giving Shir on this Monday, and we'll do something on tomorrow, let's say at 11 or so, we'll do something completely different. All right. I apologize again for being late, although I warn you it may happen again on Thursday. Usually we try and be done not later than 12:30. Okay. Yes, sir.
For that, my hooker, which came first, the Kushir, the